doing, and it's becoming partly an interview with you and about your life, so we can continue going into maybe the UFO topic and things like that that you've written on, and we'll interweave Garrett as it comes by, you know what I mean, as we think of something.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, yeah, that's good. So it's he's an important guy, this Paris Flamand, so, you know, in retrospect, I mean, I knew he was, but it's coming out deeper in the interview, so it's both him and Garrett we're doing.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And, I mean, he did the first, you know, Art Bell show.
Oh, he did?
No,
Long John, yeah, right, Neville.
They started the
right, they started that genre.
Yeah, so that's important, and he's done so much other things. Okay, so we agreed that I would send him an email next Saturday to remind him to do Sunday, and sounds good, you know, it's going good. So,
very good.
Was your computer able to go on indefinitely?
I paused it. No, I waited for a pause in the conversation. I quickly hit stop and then restart, and didn't miss any words at the 1 hour mark. So it's on 2 1-hour tracks right now.
Right, and you went over a bit of the second hour, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Which is okay. It can handle that.
Oh yeah.
As a matter of fact, so next week if we do a long thing, at some point. You know, if there's a pause, or maybe I'll pause, you know, wait for a pause, and I'll say, hey, Scott, you want to do the flip over now? And we'll do it easier, maybe, somehow like that.
Yeah, I don't like to interrupt the flow.
Right.
And I don't know if it's necessary. What I'll do is I'll post the 2 1-hour tracks that I have to a secret spot. You can listen to them during the week.
Yeah.
You can tell me if you think that it's the
flip over fucked up.
Yeah.
The flip over fucked up. But you don't think you lost any words miraculously?
No. It may. Someone may notice that there's a splice there because the words might not line up perfectly. But there was like somebody was going hemming and hawing right when I did it, so it wasn't like we missed any information.
Good.
Yeah.
That's the key point. It doesn't matter if they think that we. We turn the tape over, that's okay.
Right.
We're not into the aesthetics. We're just into the information.
Yeah.
So, okay, so what... we were going to talk about something. Oh, the pictures. Let me have a break. I'm going to take an hour or two off and eat something and that, and I'll call you back and we'll do the Garrett pictures or whatever extra stuff we had to talk about.
Oh, sounds good.
Yeah, and you'll be there, right?
Yeah, so... It's 9 o'clock, 9:15 your time. What,
yeah.
You're going to call me around 10 or something?
Yeah, maybe even 10:30.
Okay, I'll be here.
Yeah, so let me think. What else? I'm really happy with the way it went.
Oh, it's awesome. It's awesome. It's really good.
Yeah.
I was thinking, Karen says she knows something about the Kennedy assassination, which she has a high level of certainty. I always roll my eyes up when people say stuff like that because everybody thinks they know something. But she said she had a friend who witnessed, who was there doing a Joint Chief of Staff meeting, and I think the Navy was represented there when they said, we got to get rid of this guy.
Right.
So I was wondering if I should have her tell you that story just to add to whatever you know or whatever stories you're collecting on the subject.
Right. No, she can tell me, but I know who did it, you know.
Right.
And I would slightly disagree with Paris, but I'm not going to make an issue out of it because I can't prove what I know. I mean, I don't have any documents or anything.
Right.
So, but yeah, I'll hear her story. Maybe it jives with what I believe, you know, in some way.
Well, hold on a second. It'll only take her a second to tell you. She's right in the next room. Hold on a second.
Okay.
Can you hear me on this phone?
Yeah.
Would you tell Bob the story you told me about your friend who was at the Joint Chief of Staff meeting when they said that they were going to off Kennedy?
Yeah.
You don't mind telling him that story?
You just told it to him.
Well, I don't. You know more about the details.
Hi.
Hey, Karen. How you doing?
Okay. It was my friend whose father was the admiral in charge of Europe at the time.
Right.
And the Joint Chiefs were meeting there, and she overheard them talking about the plot to get rid of Kennedy.
The admiral for Europe was a woman.
The admiral, well, her father's name was Sweeney, Admiral Sweeney.
Right. And your friend overheard them?
Yes, she was a teenager at the time.
And overheard them talking about it in her home?
Right.
And that would be, they were having a meeting?
Evidently they were, because she and her folks were living in Europe at the time, yeah.
Right, so what did she hear?
She heard them talking about a plot to get rid of Kennedy.
Yeah, not who would do it or anything, just that they were aware of it or were initiating it.
That it was going to be a joint thing between them and, in other words, it was going to involve the government, the military, and also there was another part of it that was non-military. So it was a joint plot type of thing.
And when you say the government, does that mean military or that's another element?
Military.
Yeah, government as military.
The military-industrial complex people, yes.
Right, right. And the non-military.
That there was a non-military component, but I don't know what that was.
Well, probably be the mafia.
Maybe the mafia, maybe the CIA, maybe who knows what. I don't know.
Right. So the thing is, she hears that before it's going to happen. Did it affect her emotionally?
Well, she never forgot it, and she had some alcohol problems when she got older.
Right, right. And she...
Behind it, you know, and her feelings about her father were compromised.
Yeah, yeah. So then, you know, she hears this, then it's on TV, and then she has to deal with that trauma from that point on.
Yeah, but it was sometime later. It wasn't, like, within a week. This was, like, 6 months to a year before it happened.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure it was terrible for her.
Yeah. Where is she today?
In Southern California.
Right. Is that where you grew up?
No, I grew up in the Midwest, in Illinois.
Illinois. But then you were in California for many years, right?
Right. I moved to California in my early 20s,
right.
And I was there for 30 years, right?
Yeah. Okay, so, well, thanks for telling me that. That's possible, that's probable, or that can fit into what we know.
Yeah, it doesn't mean that they're the ones that did it, but they were planning to do it anyway.
Yeah, they knew it was happening.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, he was a dangerous person, you know.
Kennedy was, yeah.
Yeah. Here you go. Here's Scott.
Okay, thanks,
right.
Karen.
There you go.
Yeah. See, that's within probability or possibility is the way she's describing it.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so, I can't think of any right now. I need a break. I'm sort of probably tired from paying attention to him because it was hard to hear what he was saying or, you know, it was good enough, but you had to pay real strong attention. Now, the vocal, the way you produce it, would have him and me being equal volume?
I hope so. I've got to go back and listen to it. I'm reasonably confident that it's going to turn out just fine because you both were sounded at the same level on my phone. When we started with Worcester, I knew there was going to be problematic because his end of the conversation was weak to begin with, but then it equalized later on. But you guys both started out very clear and strong.
Right. It's just that the way his phone was weaker for some reason. Or you didn't have the equipment to balance with Worcester?
I don't have really. I can't do much with balancing. You know, I have to take what it is. I can do a little bit of grooming of the material after the fact.
Right.
And
why would Worcester's be faint or not?
Well,
good?
Worcester was mumbling a little bit, and he was a little bit in a trance. Remember in the beginning, and then when we got cut off, he was going into trance mode or something.
Yeah. So it wasn't technology; it was Worcester himself that made.
Right.
I just finished editing it today.
Oh, good.
Yeah, so because did I tell you that it's going to be put in Paranoia magazine? Did I tell you that?
Yeah, you mentioned that.
Yeah, she's going to put only 5,000 words in Paranoia, so I got to kind of select the basics. And then the full thing will be in the journal. Did I explain that to you?
On the website?
No, there's this thing she started called the Hunter-Gatherist Journal.
Oh, yeah? Is that on the internet, or that's a publication?
Yeah. Go to, I'll send you the Earl's HunterGatherist.com or something.
Right.
A publication. It's a big, bigger than a magazine, like half a book magazine kind of combination.
Right.
And Carol's got an article in there, and so she put that out a month or so ago, and now she's going to do another one, and we'll have the full interview of Worcester in that one.
Oh, awesome.
And then I don't know when she'll want to, or if she will want to put the audio up. We'll wait. I'll talk to her about that. And if she won't put it up, we'll put it on Five Body.
Right.
But, you know, I got Monsquaz to do the basics, and then I had to go through and listen to the audio and fine-tune it.
Yeah.
So I finished that. I got the first two parts, two audio sections done before I went away, and I just finished the third part now.
Oh, good.
So I have to get it to her by May 15th, some 5,000-word version.
Right.
Okay, so that's going on, and yeah, this Paris Vermont thing is pretty good. So, and isn't it amazing that he knew Garrett and all this Garrett stuff? That's pretty neat, isn't it?
Oh, he was a very impressive man.
Garrett?
No, Lamont.
Right, but isn't it amazing that we find out that he's a friend of Garrett's?
Well, you knew that. That's why the whole point of calling him. You knew that already.
Right, but I'm saying, isn't it interesting what he has to say about Garrett? Doesn't he? I mean, this is an important person who knew Garrett.
Right.
I mean, the two of them go together so well.
Yeah, right. They sounded like they were very comfortable with each other.
Yeah.
And he did say that, you know, Garrett didn't stand out necessarily above the pack because he knew so many interesting people, but Garrett was more than an acquaintance. He was a friend, and that was nice.
Right. No, the thing is, he does say that there was no one like Garrett.
He was unique, yeah.
Yeah, he was unique, but in he would blow people away if he was in Kansas, but he would be up against a lot of competition and posers or imitators in New York.
Right.
But I get a sense that...
Did Garrett ever perform Shakespeare?
Oh, yeah, he did everything. He was.
There's a movie that... hold on a second. I'm trying to think if I can remember the name. Hold on, just want to ask Karen real quick.
Remember that movie with Peter Falk?
She doesn't remember the name of it. I have to look it up, and I don't even know if it's important. But she rented a movie, which I watched like a couple months ago. Peter Falk, you know, the guy that played Columbo.
Yeah.
He plays this eccentric Shakespearean actor who's retired, and he lives in the village. And the whole thing is that he puts the message out to his family that he's going to commit suicide, not because he's depressed, but because he realizes he's getting to the age where his body's starting to deteriorate, and he'd rather go out on a high because he's had such an exciting, wonderful, adventurous life. He'd inspired so many people, and he wanted to go out, you know, remembering himself in his prime or something like that. It was a kind of weird concept. He doesn't kill himself in the end, but he was he apparently would like go out on the balcony of his apartment in New York and start performing Shakespeare, and people would gather on the street and become inspired by his performances, which were just impromptu, unplanned. And he was so eccentric that in a way he reminded me of Garrett.
Right. Yeah, Garrett was an actor. He performed on Broadway. So, but that would be before Flamand knew him.
Now, did you know Garrett the same time Flamand knew him?
Yes, actually I did, but I'm not going to go into that. It'll confuse. I don't want him to know who I am.
Why? You think you might have crossed paths?
No, I did not. I did not meet Garrett till he came to Dartmouth in the late 50s.
Right.
Yeah, I didn't know. I did not know Garrett. If you look at the diaries, there was this amazing synchronous moment when I came in 53, late 52, early 53, somewhere in there, 53 going into 54, and someone points out a character.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in the village with Marcel Duchamp, I think it is, or someone connected to that. that those people that my father knew, and they point out this guy, and they say, that's an interesting guy, and I think they say his name. And that means nothing to me at the time, but then when I meet him about 4 years later in Halifax, in Dartmouth, I recalled, oh, yeah, that's the guy someone pointed out to me. And so that's,
you mean Garrett?
Beg your pardon?
You're referring to Garrett right now.
Yeah. See, so in New York, someone pointed me out. I have the diary entry in there, or it hasn't been posted.
Right. Well, why did you say you don't want Flamand to know who you are? Why would he know who you are?
Because I was involved with the Kennedy assassination.
Yeah, but I asked you if you crossed paths with Garrett at the same time that Flamand would have, and you said, oh, no, I don't want to, that's confusing, and I don't want him to know who I am. Why would any of that tie in?
Okay, he's a major researcher of the Kennedy assassination.
I know.
Now, if he found out what I claim and what I know, that would alter our relationship into a problem.
Yeah.
So I don't want him to know about that part. If he finds it out over the Internet over time, that's good. But I don't want it to interrupt this whole Garrett memory. So I'm
right.
I don't want him to know much about me while we do Garrett.
Yeah.
I think if I do become friends with him through this, I will maybe talk to him on the phone a little bit and see how what other levels I can bring in. I was pretty impressed with what he had to say.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's a knowledgeable student of the whole thing.
Right.
But, you know, once the Evergreens told me, they said, there will be someone you can tell about the Kennedy assassination, and you will meet him someday, and you will know immediately that, or not immediately, but you will know that person is one you could tell them what you know.
Uh-huh.
And I haven't felt I've met that person yet.
Oh.
But if this carries on, Paris might be a candidate.
Yeah. As it stands right now, even if you told him what you know, he wouldn't be able to verify it because he doesn't know what really happened and doesn't think it's discoverable.
Right. But I would be able to tell him some things that would blow him away that maybe I don't have the documents, but the logic of it might open his mind to some things, because he's probably got some facts in his mind that are dangling and there's nothing to work with, so he can't figure it out.
Or maybe he has some documentation to prove what you know, but he doesn't know it.
That's right. That's what I mean. There's a potential here for us to go in that. And to me, I sentimentally think he is the guy because of the synchronicity of the Garrett connection.
Right.
You know, how would the Evergreens say to me, you will know when you meet him. Now, what way would I know? You know what I mean? What could it be? Well, fuck, this Garrett thing is a unique way to see what the Evergreens are pointing out, you know?
Yeah. When did he say that he knew Garrett? What years?
Early 50s, probably 53.
So you could have, potentially crossed tracks, but probably not.
No, because I was only in the village. See, I come over here, and I'm on my way to Halifax. That's where I'm stationed in 53, early 54, and I'm on my way to Toronto to see who this McLuhan guy is. And because I had friends here and friends of my father, I went to New York on the way to Toronto, and I remember Garrett being pointed out, and I only knew what that meant years later when I heard the name more prominently when I met Garrett. But when I was more stationed in Canada, 53, 54 to 57, and it was when the UFO thing started with George Adamski and the flap in out in California, that I went out to California. And that's why I've always had a fondness for California more than New York, is because that was my experience of American culture in depth in the late 50s. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The UFO thing, and that's how I met Zappa and Beefheart when they were kids. So I was not involved in the village scene in the 50s in New York very much, and I wouldn't have been around any Paris Flamand's events. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and so what possessed you? So somebody pointed Garrett out to you. What, they just pointed out, oh, there's an eccentric, interesting guy, and you made a note of it.
They knew him, yeah.
Yeah, and then what possessed you to actually go meet him later on?
Oh, I met him in Dartmouth because he would come back. He wasn't living in Dartmouth. He didn't start living in Dartmouth till regularly for a long stretch of time, to the late 60s,
uh-huh.
67, 68, which he's getting. That's why I was pointing out, did Garrett talk about being disillusioned? And he says, yes. And he sees Garrett up to 65, and I know Garrett's disillusioned about New York by the early 60s, and he's definitely making moves not to be there as much by 67, 68. So it totally matches with what Paris is saying.
Yeah, that by then it was a bunch of posers that were moving in. Is that what he said?
Yeah, and also the Hilton knocked down the block that Garrett was on, you know what I mean?
Mm.
Probably affected his. That's interesting. He says it's right beside Ziegfeld Follies. I'm going to go check that out. That's incredible because I know that is the street, but now I can see where the Paris Hilton is. I can't remember offhand. I'll go down and see how close the Paris Hilton is to Ziegfeld Follies, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But he was pissed off at what Rockefeller was doing in New York, so. So what was I saying here? It was the sort of the culture, sort of the what was happening to Midtown New York, and the changing of the architecture. Yeah, a lot of things. And Paris is filling in some of the points. So, but the thing is that Garrett goes back and he's in Dartmouth, Halifax, visiting his parents. His mother was still alive. She died in '59, and so he's walking around the town. And you can't miss Garrett, you know what I mean? You would see him. And so I encountered him on the street or something like that. Just a guy I noticed, and then we started talking. And I became a friend kind of like the same way Paris did.
You just sort of became enchanted by him.
Yeah, and he was made Halifax Dartmouth interesting.
Yeah.
So I met him, and I wasn't introduced to him or anything. I just met him on the street and noticed he and I'm you know, I'm a savvy person. I see someone interesting. I'm not going to be afraid to talk to them, so I probably introduce myself to them.
Yeah. And
it was a gradual. It's not a startling. I have a vague, you know, it's not a striking original meeting. It was a vague getting acclimatized to interacting with them.
Right. The little bit of recording you have of him in Furry Lent, is that the entirety of your having recorded him?
No, I've got hours of him.
Oh. Something I have to see when we review the session, but I think at one point Lamont said he had an opportunity to meet Kerouac and he wouldn't have anything to do with it.
No, it wasn't that. He said, I think he said that.
But I was surprised you didn't, like, pick up on that point, find out what, inquire as to what that was about.
Well, he eventually did explain that. He said he represented another school of poetry.
Yeah. And nevertheless, even if you didn't like Kerouac's poetry, an opportunity to meet, you know, someone,
he wasn't impressed with those guys. Like,
yeah.
They were punks, and... I mean, The Howl, which is now considered classic, and his sensibility, the first 10 lines were okay, maybe 20 lines, the rest is junk. He was not, and he had a whole scene in New York. He was like the establishment.
Yeah.
He's putting on poetry readings and symposia, and he's in with all the stars and all that, and Ginsberg and him are just younger kids.
Yeah. No, I agree that what he was involved with was a higher form of culture.
Well, it was the old-fashioned form of New York literary culture.
Yeah, but I think it was a more sophisticated culture, honestly. I mean, I just was watching a film this morning about Ginsberg, Burroughs, and Kerouac, and I remember, you know, first of all, Burroughs was so sardonic. You know, he's interesting to explore for a little bit, but his spirit was kind of, it was chaotic and a bit mean or nasty or something. And then I remember reading On the Road and not being that impressed with it. I mean, it seemed like these guys were a bit reckless. They weren't really, none of them really were all that healthy when they died. Although Ginsberg was, he seemed to be, of the three of them, he seemed to have the healthiest life. But,
even though he was very sick for a long time.
Yeah. But
healthy, you mean healthy in spirit?
Well, yeah, and he lived long, and he had many, many genuinely deep friendships with people who were changing culture. He was deeply respected.
But, you know, I don't know how healthy that whole movement was, really.
No, I agree. Let's not go into it right now, but I understand. I know exactly. That's why I like playing off Bukowski with them. You know, Bukowski, even though he wasn't necessarily healthy, I agree with his objection to them in a certain way.
But see, it's taken me a long time to really find my way into a deeper appreciation of Zappa. At first, he seemed sort of chaotic and disrespectful of ordinary human emotional tones or something. And now I'm finding that he's just, you know, increasingly I'm just blown away by. And I wonder what, you know, I don't think Paris would appreciate Zappa. He would be able to appreciate what Zappa's contribution was. He probably would just hear that as being noise and wouldn't be able to transition into it.
Right. I'll bring that. We'll do Dylan, then we'll move into Zappa a bit, but I imagine he didn't even know who Zappa was. I mean, that it's all noise to him. He's too old-fashioned. He's too literary sensibility.
Yeah.
He's kind of old-fashioned, and it always struck me. I noticed what's great about this, the revelation, is I suspected Garrett was not too keen on the Ginsberg and the way culture went. And I said, he represents something old-fashioned. I was wondering if he's old-fashioned. He represented an older part of New York, and he was older than Paris. But what's interesting is that Paris is younger, but he represents a thread that Garrett was part of before Paris, but Paris keeps it going.
Yeah.
And that is what...
But it's the East Coast sensibility. The Beats were about moving to the great open Western unlimited potential, golden fields, open roads.
Car culture, whereas Paris is the verbal literary salon culture of New York.
Right.
I mean, that's what McLuhan said Annie Hall was about. It was about the battle between New York and L.A. Yeah, and the counterculture is more L.A.
Yeah.
More modern media moving around, kinetic.
Right.
Whereas Paris is visual and oral.
Right.
And so his sensibility of proper poetry is a visual and oral discipline.
Right.
I mean, Ginsberg is doing poetry while riding down the highways.
I mean, he did say that he liked he thought the first 20 lines of Howl were, you know, very good. The first 40 lines were pretty good, and then after that, it just started to devolve into, you know, mad ramblings.
Right, and that is really that's kinetic tactile culture and jazz wailing, that is not the verbal oral stuff that New York and Paris represents.
Yeah.
So that was really good to hear him. That clarified an image I had of Garrett, and I said, well, Garrett is aligned with you guys.
Yeah.
And he said, yeah.
There's an interesting, they had an interesting little clip of Ginsberg in this film where the guy asked him, this was in the 60s or 70s, I guess this was in the 70s. He goes, do you have a nostalgia for the 50s and 60s? And Ginsberg said something to the effect, well, no, I mean, right now is just as interesting as the 50s and 60s. In fact, we were in eternity in the 50s and 60s, and we're in eternity now. And how can you have nostalgia for eternity?
Mm-hmm.
So,
now, what film is this? Is this that Part Two thing?
No, this is something different that I rented.
Is it good?
Yeah, some of it. Some of it's amateurish, but it has a few golden moments in it.
Send me the title.
Okay.
Sometimes. So the thing is, what was I going to say? You have to realize Garrett's older. He's dealing with being a gay guy. He's fighting the gay cause ahead of everybody. So he's under that kind of tension, and he's got a rearview mirror image, you know, of Oscar Wilde, and he's using that as his hero. That's a whole different world than Ginsberg in the 60s-70s, where the gay thing wasn't as bad, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, well, Ginsberg is more dealing with the discarnate world.
Yeah.
The drug effect of electric satellites and everything, all that is...
Right. That's the comment I just made about, well, you know, we're in eternity. We've been in eternity. How can you have nostalgia for, you know, eternity?
Well, I don't mean eternity. I'm talking about the sensibilities that electric music brought in. And then
it gives you the sense that you've broken out of time and that you're in some eternal space.
Right.
I don't know if it was the word eternity. There might be another word that is similar to eternity.
Well, there's the private citadel consciousness version of eternity, then there's the electric effect of eternity.
Right.
The electric effect of the secular, second nature eternity is where we're at now with, you know, constant information accessibility.
Right.
But that would, into a literate Gnostic like Ginsberg, it would flip into visions of eternity-ness. But that's the thing about his poetry. It's all mixed up with the media effects. So, you know, it may be a different sense of eternity than Shakespeare had.
Oh, yeah.
Anyways, that was really good to get that. To me, that crystallized something about Garrett. Talking to Paris, I'm learning a bit more about Garrett.
Yeah.
About what was going on there in New York.
Oh, this Paris has had a very interesting life.
Yeah.
And didn't he say towards the end that he's ready to, you know, cast off Clay because this isn't his era anymore? He's not really interested in what's going on anymore?
That's right. And you see that in his volume, The Assassination of America. You see that, how he concludes the book kind of like that. And he says, it's not the same America anymore.
Yeah.
And what is it? He helped Jim Garrison in the Kennedy assassination, and he met all these other people in the UFO field. You know, he's covered a lot of interesting zones. He's actually like Art Bell's range of interest before Art Bell, before it became a popular culture thing.
Yeah. And he blew the lid off the candy thing, the John Lon Silver's girlfriend.
He thought it was
all just blown out of proportion and somebody's imagination ran away with him.
Right, he knew the people.
Yeah.
He knew his girlfriend, so...
That undermines the whole Bogart phenomena.
Which agrees with me. That's what I say.
Oh, did Bogart know you felt that way?
Oh, yeah. I even, to kind of prove it to him, I played him the Evergreens talking about it.
Oh, that's why he had a sort of love-hate relationship with you. He didn't like that you were undermining him, but he probably knew you were right.
yeah, that's right. And so that's why I brought up the Candy Jones. I didn't know what he was going to say, but to me it confirms my side of the story.
Yeah.
So that's a big discovery within that context that we got. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
So he doesn't know it. It's resonating with a lot of Dobbsian issues, you know, in the media.
Yeah.
Or what I say in the media. So, as usual, it's working for me, this interview.
Yeah. Well, he's probably thrilled to death to be able to do a life review with someone like you who can actually appreciate, you know, his life.
Yeah, that's good. Okay, so I'll call you back later.
Okay.
Okay, bye.
Bye.